Yeah, well.
Hand over this, Mikhail.
Well, thank you to Johnny and Dean, and very shortly we will be hearing from all about our favourite subject, web harvesting. So I'd like to introduce Mr. Gordon Painter from the National Library.
Can everybody hear me all right? Good thing I wore a tie. Okay. Get this going. Hi, as you've just heard, my name is Gordon. I work at the National Library. Technically speaking, I work for the Innovation Centre in the National Digital Library, which is part of the National Library, and I'm a technical analyst. And rather than trying to explain what all that means, I thought I would start out by showing you some examples of what I do. And this is a picture of some newspapers, some very old newspapers in the National Library, and one of the main things that I do is work on digitization projects, so kind of taking from the newspapers into some online thing that you can look at. So this is our Papers Past website. My involvement in this, back when we were doing a lot of research around it, we wanted to know if it was possible to digitize things in a useful way, and if we could then OCR them and make them searchable in a useful way. I was kind of the project manager on that whole process, and I was the technical resource as well, so I spent a lot of time juggling standards for various types of documents and doing XML things and things like that. Now that's sort of been handed over into production, so I'm not really involved anymore until there's a problem with the software and they come back to me and say, you know, it's broken and it's your fault. This is another website that I was involved in. It's kind of a library application, the Kiwi Research Information Service. When I was involved, this was called the National Research Discovery Service Project, but once we handed it over to the steering committee, none of them wanted to be involved with the NERDS project. So they renamed it to CRIS because they thought they could kind of get some leverage off Karen, the Advanced Research Network, by talking about CRIS and Karen. Anyway, again, I was a project manager, and in this case I was a coder as well, I guess. This is something I have going on at the moment, Digital New Zealand. This is quite a large program of work over the next few years to basically make digital content online in New Zealand easier to find, share and use. And there's way too much stuff going on there to give you any sort of idea of what it is, but hopefully you'll hear a lot more about it in 2009. My position in this, I'm called the technical architect. That's not a title I gave myself. I kind of get all the software developers to work together in the same way and organize what I can of the technology. Getting a bit more towards the topic of today's talk, the Web Curator tool was one of my first projects at the library, and this is a piece of software that we built with the British Library. It was a joint project to let librarians harvest websites that they were interested in, and once they'd harvested them, to quality review them and submit them to an archive. So again, I was the project manager on this, and it was a case of, you know, leading a team from the National Library and the British Library and getting requirements from all around the place and putting up an RFP and doing lots of really boring evaluations of that kind of thing. And at the end of the day, we sort of have this tool. And I'll tell you quite a bit more about this later as kind of background to the whole of the main harvest. More background to that, I guess. There's this thing called the International Internet Preservation Consortium. And this is a group of national libraries and the Internet Archive and a few other non-profits and a few university libraries and specialist libraries who have an interest in harvesting websites and archiving them for a rainy day, I guess. Now, the National Library has been involved for a long time, and at the moment we have about 50 members in this organisation, and I'm on the technical committee for that thing where we kind of look at projects that are coming up and approve them and say whether we think they'll be useful and send them off to people to work on. So, as a result of this, I got given this project, which I don't really have a picture of, but it's the New Zealand Web Harvest 2008. This is something we've been thinking about for a long time and we've wanted to do, and we've had the opportunity this year, and I guess you'll hear about our experience with this stuff today. This slide is where I try and explain to you where my what I know about in a way that sort of places my expertise relative to network stuff. My background is technical. I was in the computer science department at the University of Waikato for about 10 years, working on software engineering, user interfaces and machine learning and things like that. But if you start from the bottom of this diagram where we've got the OSI 7-layer network model sort of layers, you'll see that I'm not really a hardware person, so I don't know anything about that bottom part. But if you start from the top, and we've got sort of a multi-tier software architecture thing up there, my expertise is really at the top, particularly in the application area and presentation in the data layer. And I know a bit about the very top layer of the network stuff, so DNS, FTP. I know what all these acronyms are, and I've programmed with some of them, but a lot less as you go further down. And I guess this is somewhat by way of a disclaimer. I imagine that most people here, if they were putting the little green bars on for themselves, they would have quite a different curve with more of a bulge at the bottom. So with I guess, introductions behind us, we'll go on to some background to the work we've been doing. The first thing is, why collect the web? A lot of people, you know, sort of question why the National Library even bothers to do this. And you can sort of see some pictures here of some of the more traditional stuff we have on our shelves, the newspapers, the books, and the little card catalogues and things. But the National Library actually has a social responsibility and legal mandate to preserve all of our social and cultural history, give or take. And particularly our focus is on our documentary history. And it's not just books and things, it's also unpublished material like people's journals and diaries. And we have increasingly been seeing digital things coming along. And we've also increasingly found that because we're kind of in one little fortress-like building in Wellington where very few people come, if we can put things online, digitise them, put them online, they'll be a lot more accessible to people all around the country. And obviously, we're not the only people who have noticed this. So increasingly, we're seeing that documents that would previously have come out as press releases and bits of paper that would come into the library are just coming out as websites and things. And hence we start getting into this area of harvesting websites. So there you've got your own website, the NZNOG one, and down the bottom there, a more complicated example of a multimedia document. So we've got the National Party website, and we've got a little embedded YouTube video of John Key. No doubt he's about to tell us how we're all going to get faster broadband. And we're not entirely sure where we're going to draw the line with something like YouTube, whether is that, you know, is this a document that the National Library would be normally getting, or is it something that maybe the Film Archive is more interested in? But, you know, at the same time, if we don't do something sort of now, the stuff disappears. Paper lasts a lot longer than stuff on the internet, so, and clearly there is a lot of stuff in there that is never going to be printed out in any sort of usable form that we can store. So we've certainly got into web harvesting in a big way, relative to our size, I guess. But the legal background to this is that the library actually realised fairly early on that it was going to be important to harvest the websites and things, and when the National Library of New Zealand Act in 2003 was passed, it actually included several provisions for extending what we call legal deposit law so that they would cover documents on the internet. Now, legal deposit you've probably heard of, it's the kind of the rule or law that whenever a printer publishes a book, they have to give a copy or two copies to the National Library, and pretty much every country in the world has the same law. And what the Act of 2003 did was it added a whole bunch of new definitions, such as electronic document and public document, internet document, and it even defined make a copy so that they could extend the law so that harvesting websites and archiving and storing them and making them accessible later was all part of the National Library's legislative mandate. And you can go online there and have a look at the Act. There's a whole bunch of these definitions, and then there's stuff about how the Minister has to put out a notice saying that they're going to do this, which she duly did in 2006. So since, I think, August the 12th, 2006, the National Library has the legal mandate to go out and harvest things from the internet that are publicly available. There's a lot more in there about defining things which are protected by passwords and things like that. You know, are they published? In many cases they are, and technically, well, legally speaking, you could go and get them, but technically it's hard enough getting the stuff which isn't. So it's one big trade-off. At the library, we have two web archiving programs on the go. There's the whole of domain harvesting, which is what I'm going to talk to you about today. And this is where we kind of grab what we can and suck it all down. And there's not a lot of selection going on. We set a few general rules about scope, and then we take what we can get. The other form of harvesting is selective harvesting. And the National Library has a lot more experience in this. We've been doing it since about 2000. And this is where we sort of identify high-value websites that we want, and the curators actually go in and use the web curator tool. That's what's showing on the screen here. This is sort of the main menu of this tool. And they sort of define the website that they want and describe it a bit and say where it is. And they schedule how often they want it harvested, and then the tool goes off and downloads it all and makes a copy. And later on, the librarians get a message saying, you know, the harvest has happened, and they quality review it. And when they're finished with it, they submit it to the archive. And at this point, it's quite a mature process. We have this whole architecture around the preservation of the websites gathered in this way. You can see in the middle there we've got the NDHA archive. That's the National Digital Heritage Archive. It's another national library project which has been going on for 2.5 or 3 years now. It's a 4-year project. And it's just gone online, basically. So we actually have a digital preservation system where we can put things now. So those of you who know stuff about preservation will see this is basically an OAIS model with an archive in the middle and submissions on the left. The submission tools include the web curator tool. And on the right-hand side, we've got access tools. And I've highlighted something called the Arc Viewer there, which is not very intuitive name they gave to the component that lets you actually access websites. Down the bottom there, you see the connection management systems is connected up. Collection management systems is library speak for catalogue. When you do a search in our library catalogue now, if you get a result, you might get a result for a website harvest. And in this case, we've got the website of the Young Singers in Harmony. And it's got in square brackets after electronic resource, as librarians like to qualify this. I don't know, it's not a real thing. It's it's an internet website. And down in the bottom there, you've got a link to the archive copy. And we can actually go up to the archive copy, and the users can sort of see something like this. And I don't know if you can read that red bar across the top of that web page there, but what it says is, the archived website shown below is provided by the National Library of New Zealand. Normal copyright restrictions apply. Date of harvest, 15 May 2008 at 10:05 a.m. So this is kind of the model that we have in place for the selective web archiving. And since 2007, when we started doing this in Angular with the web curator tool, this is kind of a bit of a profile of how much we've done. In total, we've successfully harvested, what's that, about 2,700 websites. There's actually a few more which, at this point in time, are neither in the accepted and endorsed stage, which is what the purple bars are, nor are they in the rejected stage, where because we're still trying to figure out whether or not they're of good enough quality to be archived. And you can see at the beginning of this graph, we didn't do very much harvesting because we were kind of breaking the software in. Then we had a big peak in 2007 for the local body elections. That's what we call an event harvest, where we do spend a lot of effort around a particular event and getting all the perspectives on it. In 2008, we did a lot more harvesting, particularly in the second half of the year, because we managed to get enough staff member to actually run the tool. And you can see the 2008 general election was another event harvest. And probably, I don't know, half of the websites we harvested in 2008 were in sort of September, October, November, and were related to that general election. So some of the things we've learned from this process is that we'll always struggle to keep up with the net. YouTube has just been a disaster for me personally, because the curators decided fairly early on that for the election, YouTube was the one thing that they really wanted to harvest that they couldn't now. So I spent a lot of time reverse engineering how that funny little flash player on YouTube works and getting it all set up so that the web curator tool could harvest them and we could link to the archive. And then sort of halfway through October, YouTube just changed the way that the player worked, and everything that I did was completely pointless, and we didn't actually manage to harvest any of it at the time anyway. We had to go back in the second half of November when we realised we didn't have it and repeat all these harvests. So that was one challenge, and I'm guessing that, you know, in 3 or 4 months' time, they'll change the way they do things again, and I'll have to repeat the process. So it's a struggle to keep up. MySpace Music is the next thing they want. The curators have got a list of like 300 websites for New Zealand bands, and about 65% of them have MySpace pages, and MySpace has this little flash widget that you can put on there which plays the songs and stuff like this, and they want to capture all that stuff. So I'm going to have to do the same process, and anything to do with Flash is just a real nuisance. It's very hard to harvest. Anything to do with Ajax. Even basic JavaScript can be very difficult, because the harvester doesn't interact with web pages, so you never really get a complete thing. And also, the harvester doesn't even know how to parse web pages. It downloads it, but it's not going to spend a lot of time interpreting HTML and things like that. That's just too hard. So what it does is it just runs some regular expressions over it and thinks, oh, maybe that's URL, maybe that's URL, maybe that's URL, and tries them later on. And some of you who may have websites where you've noticed our harvester coming in and making all sorts of weird requests, that's kind of the source of these requests. Now, the harvester in question is called Heritrix, and despite these problems, it is the best web harvester for preservation. The thing about preservation is that we really want to preserve the bit streams and all the information about them. there's a lot of programs out there which sort of bill themselves as website copiers, and they'll go out and grab a website and find all the links and download them, and they'll save all of the things that they get in a nice file system structure, and they'll rewrite all the links as kind of relative links so that you can click around them in your browser. But for preservation purposes, that's not what we want, because there's sort of this post-handling that is really it's just bad practice. So what we want to do is save all of our requests and responses, by which I mean HTTP requests, HTTP responses, and we store them in a file called ARC format, which is not the old compression format. It's probably closer to TAR format. And it basically concatenates a whole bunch of requests and responses together. The advantages of this are that everything is preserved exactly, and if you were to just store all of the files individually, you would pretty quickly fill up your file system and need to do strange things with inodes and things. But ARC, you can kind of shove them all in one big file and they get compressed as they go. So it's good for preservation. It's going to be succeeded by a new format, which is an ISO standard soon, but in the moment it's the best one. However, it's bad for access, and we have discovered that the access tools lag behind the harvesting tools, as bad as the harvesting tools are. And the final thing is that we tend to talk about spiders and web crawlers a lot, but this is a really bad analogy for what you do when you're doing any sort of large-scale harvesting. There's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one is sort of you talk about a spider, and people think about this little computer program going out there on the net and following links around and stuff, and really that's not what happens. Your computer isn't going out on the net. It's sitting there and sucking stuff down to it. So immediately you've got this wrong conceptual model. Also, you don't tend to follow links around. That's just really inefficient. And you certainly don't do it one link at a time. If you did, you would wind up spending 90% of your time waiting for your responses to come back, because that's really, there's 1% of time is your CPU working stuff out, and then 99% of the time you send a request and you wait for a response. So these things are actually massively multi-processed. So I think the default for Heratrix is that it does 50 at a time, 50 queues set up, one queue per host. And normally when you would run it, you would pump that up to a couple of hundred. Although we don't use that in the web curator tool, it's certainly how things were done in the whole of the main harvest. You have a whole bunch of computers running these massively multi-processed things, and you wind up with a system that doesn't really bear any resemblance to the notion of a spider or a crawler in the sense of around the internet. So that's some of the things that we've learned. And we applied these to when we set up with the main harvest. I mean, we did think about this a lot. It's not something we went out and did. And a lot of our background, I think, in the selective harvesting may have informed some of the decisions we made, which I'll go through at the moment. So the first thing we had to decide when this landed on our desk was, did we want to do this ourselves in-house, or did we want to commission somebody to do it? And on the left-hand side here, we've got these sort of points about what happens when you do it in-house. It's cheaper, but you need a lot more staff. There's hardware and network to think about. And there's also the issue of, we haven't done this before. Is there anything that we don't know about that might bite us later? On the right-hand side, some of the features of commissioned is that, there's a cost. You give them dollars and they give you back stuff. However, the contractor provides a lot of expertise around the crawler and crawler traps and managing the scope of the crawl. And they also provide the computers and the bandwidth. And in the end, we decided to commission this harvest from the Internet Archive. The two main factors were the staff requirement. We just didn't have the staff to continuously monitor a harvester for weeks at a time, 24/7 to make sure it wasn't going off madly. And the second thing was that technical risk. We just weren't entirely sure that if we did do it, we didn't even have a very good estimate of how many computers we would need, so clearly we were babes in the wood, really. So we got the Internet Archive to do it. They do these harvests for lots of national libraries, and we think it went right well. Some of the decisions we had to make when we started were around scope of the crawl and the robots policy. The scope was it's not really easy to define, because the legal definition of what constitutes the internet and an internet document don't really match up to the technical definitions that are convenient for defining the New Zealand internet. In the end, we went for hosts in the .nz top-level domain, and we excluded a lot of them. Anything that sort of was a redirect off to overseas, like nz.yahoo.com is just a redirect to somewhere else, we would exclude. But then we had a list of about 500 hosts that weren't .nz hosts, but were within the scope of the legislation. And these are kind of put in there just to see what happened, basically. They weren't particularly valuable hosts or anything. They were just ones where it was easy to tell that they were within the scope of the legal definition of the thing. And finally, any page which had embedded images or video clips and stuff like that, we took all the embedded stuff on the assumption that, you know, if the page was in scope, then the person who put up the page was responsible for ensuring that the things they embedded it in it were, you know, following copyright. So all the way through, we're kind of balancing, you know, the fact that we have to make these broad rules and there's a risk that we'll go too far, but if we don't go far enough, then we'll lose stuff. Because in the past we've done selective crawling, we try to be as broad as possible and emphasised a couple of particular segmentable domains. Our robots policy was to ignore robots.txt unless we got a request otherwise, and we didn't do any prior notification. And I'll come back to these two points later on, because some of you had opinions about them. Just some technical information, the equipment that was used. The archive used 5 crawlers. We still call them crawlers, even though it's a bad analogy. They used 5 crawlers for this harvest. They're all fairly modern machines running Linux, and you can see Heritrix on Java. Each node can harvest 4 million URLs a day, so that's 20 million URLs per day for our 5 nodes. The reality is that when a harvest starts, so you've got a harvest that's a few weeks long, then you can do quite a bit more than 4 million URLs per day, but it's not very long until the sheer computational complexity of remembering where you've already been slows you down so much that it drops well below 4 million URLs a day. And people who do large-scale crawling spend a lot of time figuring out efficient ways to remember, have I seen this URL before? And, we, of course, are glad we didn't have to deal with that ourselves. In terms of network, I don't know quite what to call this slide, actually. The way that the infrastructure was set up was that the Internet Archive have a partner called ISC.org. Apparently they have some presence in New Zealand, but I'm not sure in what form. Maybe I'll learn about that today or tomorrow. And they provide about 550 nodes in California and some dark fiber linking the archive to traditional network backbones. So in our case, we were limited to about 200 megabits per second of this available bandwidth. By way of comparison, the library has 100 megabits per second connection, and we were thinking if we did it in-house, maybe we would use 30-40% of that, so we would obviously have taken, I don't know, twice as long or a bit longer. So, and of course there was the issue of IP addresses. Traffic went out over the ISC.org IP, but when you ignore robots.txt as much as we do, and in fact any large-scale domain harvest does, your IP address tends to get blacklisted a lot, which is one of the things that we learned, one of these technical risk things. We're glad we did it this way because we wouldn't want, for example, the National Library's IP to be blocked by all these websites. That would be a very bad look for me personally and professionally. So that was good. So once it was all set up, we kicked off the harvest and ran it. And this was a bit of an anticlimax, actually, because we'd had all this build-up over years and all this planning, and, you know, one day I got an email, oh, by the way, it's already started, kind of thing, and I didn't actually have to do anything. There was some reaction. We actually ran the crawl for 10 days. We provided a web page and an email contact. We got about 40 contacts, you know, from individuals about what we were doing, 34 by email, 2 phone, and we met Gerard, who may or may not be here, in person after hearing him talking on national radio about what nice guys we were. We noticed significant mailing list discussions on NZNOG and NZWebDev, and we tried to post to that, and there was also a lot of noise on blogs and Twitter. The media was, as I said, kind of, you know, lukewarm. I love that. There's a lovely story of the comms people all gearing up for the launch of the NDHA, and it was this fantastic media opportunity, and all these reporters turned up to their interview with all the people in charge of the NDHA and said, you know, tell me about the international traffic and the whole of the main web harvest, and didn't want to know anything about what the whole comms meeting had been set up for. So after that, I was the I was well loved within our organisation by the comms department as well. Although they did tell me later on that it was actually kind of exciting that somebody had finally noticed the National Library and what they were doing. anyway, the first person to notice that we were doing this stuff was Douglas Davey, who was an admin at Waikato and who I actually knew when I was at Waikato, and or at least the first person to send me any sort of feedback. And I think that was about 24 hours after we started. It may have been 48. I need to go back and look at the timestamps because I'm not exactly sure when we started, because as I said, I just got this email to say, oh, by the way, it's already going. So we did attempt to respond to everyone who contacted us directly, but to the larger things, you know, where, you know, it was mailing lists and discussions and groups like that, we just put things on our website, and we have a blog about technology we use at the library, so we responded there as well. The comms people were keen to put out press releases and control all that stuff as well. So it was all kind of a strange exercise. And this is kind of the sort of thing that we saw. 16 requests per second does seem a bit rude, doesn't it, on this particular person's site. James has got something called Event Finder, I think. And the way that that happens is the crawler is all set up to think of hosts, each host as being a different machine. And if you've got one box which has got, you know, 50 hosts on it, it's quite possible that it will decide, well, I'm going to get all of these particular ones and they all happen to be on your box. And that's how you can get to that sort of a thing. But once we know that it's happening, we can just tune the crawler so it doesn't happen. And so in this case, we had a happy customer saying what a thoughtful and prompt response we'd given. And hopefully everybody wound up with that impression then, but who knows. In terms of what the actual feedback was, we kind of had a look at what we did in response, and I just want to pick out a few numbers in here. We got 8 emails telling us to honor robots.txt. We've got, I don't know, half a dozen more telling us just to stop, which we did, and another half a dozen saying, you know, we blocked you, and I'm sure there were many, many more out there who didn't bother to tell us that they blocked us. We also got 6 asking us to include them in the harvest because, you know, they were on a .com or a .net or something and they wanted to be included. Yeah, that's right. But by a large majority, most of the emails that came to us were either asking us something about the crawl or helpfully offering us advice about the fact that we were going to run into crawler traps and things like that, which we did already know, but it was nice that you know, people were taking the time to send us something constructive rather than just leaving abusive phone calls, for example, which did happen. and we got one person sending us an email asking us where he could send the bill for his international traffic. Luckily, by that point, the comms team had decided they were taking over this kind of interaction and I could just pass it on. The other main thing we had in terms of feedback is after the crawl, we had what we called a sort of a sector consultation meeting where we kind of fronted up and said, sorry about that kind of thing. This was attended by a couple of people at the National Library, my director and my project sponsor, also our CIO, who wasn't directly involved. There was quite a lot of disclaiming at the library for a little while. We also had the mainland commissioner there, and representatives, you can see from InternetNZ, CityLink, Dean was there, and a few others. And Dean has sent an email kind of summarising things back to the list, but I thought I'd show you what we took out of this. First one was communication. We didn't notify everybody prior to the harvest for whatever reason. We really didn't want to be seen as spammers, and we were not entirely sure that anyone would really notice because we've been doing all of the selective harvesting and no one really notices that, and we ignore robots.txt and do it from more in place. So, you know, however, we acknowledge this was a mistake and we will work with the various industry representatives and through the appropriate groups, particularly those mailing lists I mentioned before, to publicise upcoming harvests in advance. Then there's robots policy. This initially generated the most heat, I think, because it tended to affect people who were website developers who, you know, didn't really... They kind of use robot.txt files to control Google, and Google's always really respectful, but we were not, because we have legislation, you know, mandating what we're doing, and we kind of feel that it's important to ignore robots.txt to gather the quality. We found that if you don't, then you don't get much back in many cases. Everybody who does web archiving in a serious way ignores robots.txt to some degree. The question is how much you ignore it, you know, how much risk you're willing to take. And generally, the amount of risk you're willing to take is proportional to how strong your legislation is. And New Zealand is in the happy position, well, the National Library of New Zealand is in the happy position of having fairly robust legislation in that sense. Other countries, for example, Australia has no legislation covering this kind of thing. So when they do their selective harvesting, they have to email every website owner in advance and get a permission response signed, and they get like a 30% response rate. So what they did was they went out and did a whole of the main harvest anyway and got the Internet Archive to do it, and they basically got it sitting on a server somewhere. They can't let anybody look at it because technically that was a gross copyright violation to go and grab all that stuff. But they felt that, you know, if they... Yeah, it's all about managing risk. If they save it now and make it available in, you know, 25 years' time, probably no one will sue them. That's, I guess that's what they're thinking, but... libraries sometimes take the long view. So this policy was unpopular, but I don't know. I don't know if we would do it different, but we certainly will let people know in advance how we plan to do it. The other factor here is that we're kind of limited by the crawler in the sense that it's got like 3 settings for robots.txt handling. You either always follow the rules or you always ignore it, or there's this one kind of middle ground case that sort of says that you follow it in these cases and not in these cases. The other thing we're going to do is through the IIPC is get the Internet Archive to basically, what we're going to try and do, to build a lot more complexity into that so that we can, you know, behave differently if we find a website that's got a robots.txt entry which is directed at us specifically than if we find a website that's got a robots.txt entry which is directed at everybody else kind of thing. So, but that kind of complexity is not currently technically possible, but, you know, if we have our way, it will be by the time we come to do this again. And everybody's favourite issue, by the end of the 10 days, robots.txt, you know, no one cared about that anymore. The new hot topic was international traffic and the fact that some website owners pay higher fees for international traffic. I think it's fair to say this one absolutely blindsided us. We had no idea that anybody would be in that situation. It just seemed very strange. Yes, that's right. So, and we're still not really sure what the extent of the problem is. As I said, we had one person email us directly. However, when we talked to Gerard, he sort of said that what's usual in that case is that the guy who's billing you through the network and you will come to some sort of agreement and, you know, maybe you'll share the costs or something like that. And in cases like that, you know, we just wouldn't hear about it. So we'll certainly attempt to minimise the impact of the traffic charges in the future. And whether that's by, you know, situating servers in New Zealand or figuring out some other way to do that kind of thing, I don't know. But we'll certainly take it into account. We weren't setting out to shift the cost of bandwidth off somebody onto somebody else. You know, if we wanted to do it ourselves, we could have done it. It would have been slower, but it would have still got done. So there's all these things. So finally, the results. Now, there was actually one final issue that we hadn't really thought about, and that's when you stop. I don't know if you noticed, but the subtitle of the section is how long is a piece of string, or sort of how long is an infinitely stretchy piece of elastic. The internet is infinitely large, so it's very hard to say, you know, if we crawl this much, we've got the New Zealand internet, because we can just keep going, keep going, but eventually you start getting more and more junk and spam and traps and calendars and, I don't know what, collapsible trees of file structures and people's FTP sites and what have you, and less and less actual useful content, and this ratio grows, and the Internet Archive sort of said, here's a list of things that happen once you're getting towards the end of the crawl. And I think the most interesting one is you start seeing, relatively speaking, a lot more HTML appearing in the log and a lot fewer images. Once you get in that situation, you can kind of, you get the idea that you're just sort of downloading the same pages over and over again in slightly different form. Also, a lot of the host queues are crawler traps, and we kind of have something from every host we've encountered. So that was the situation we were in, and they advised us that at that point we would get, as I said, less and less useful stuff and more junk, and people will start to notice that we're overcrawling. And overcrawling, I think, is what they call it when you start, you know, downloading the same piece of information with six different CGI arguments, and it's really the same thing again and again and again, and it's an easy situation to get into. So we stopped after 10 days, but after that we were on a patch crawl to pick up some bits and pieces we thought we'd missed and to add in all the people who had volunteered their various websites to be harvested. After that, we had 106 million URLs, and, you know, we'd sort of estimated we would get 100 million, so that was quite good, and it was 4.5 terabytes as downloaded, but it compressed down to 3. We took stuff from 397,000 hosts. Remember I said we tend to think about hosts, not domains. And there were 216,000 things that the crawler thought might be hosts, but gave us a zero bytes in response. So I kind of have eliminated all of those from any sort of future analysis. By global standards, this was a shallow crawl. We got a maximum of 50,000 URLs from the things we were interested in, 10,000 from other hosts. All this data came actually on hard disk from California to us, and they sent it twice just in case one got lost. One of them we haven't even opened. The other one is actually now on our storage array, and it's backed up offsite and all that stuff. So it's basically, it's in the system and it's being preserved. It's not in the NDHA, which is something I'll come back to later, but it's pretty good. The full data set is well over 106,000 files. I'm not quite sure how big. Every so often I make the mistake of typing ls enter, and I just have to open up another window. It's just crazy stuff to work with. Even just finding out what the files are.